v. Biglari. Mr. Wagner?
Good morning, and may it please the court. Avi Wagner, on behalf of plaintiff's appellants. Just a brief logistics note, I spoke with my colleague, Ms. Wolke. I'll be handling the entirety of the opening as well, so we don't have to worry about that division.
Be sure to keep your voice up.
Yes, Your Honor. This appeal concerns three transactions which collectively entrenched respondents Sardar Biglari and the entirety of Biglari Holdings Board of Directors. First, a royalty provision in the licensing agreement made Biglari and the board irremovable. That does so because the royalty provision, if triggered, would cripple the company, destroying up to 80% or more of its net revenues. Second, the Biglari Capital transaction, I'll call Biglari Capital BCC because we have the multiple Biglaris, gave Mr. Biglari at least 5 years control over at least $326 million of the company's assets and gave him thus a 16% control block of the company's stock. It did so without deliberation or valuation of these two critical components of the transaction. It also allowed him to evade a shareholder-imposed compensation cap, where previously his compensation had been restricted to $10 million. Now, Biglari Holdings would pay BCC uncapped compensation, which could total tens of millions of dollars a year more than that $10 million figure. Finally, was the rights offering, which the company itself described as in lieu of a dual class share structure. A dual class share structure is a way traditionally of consolidating control in one share class while still continuing to increase equity, effectively retaining voting rights or expanding voter rights for that preferred class holder. And the company described the rights offering as in lieu of that, meaning to consolidate Biglari's voting control. We submit respectfully that we've raised the requisite reasonable doubt as to three or more of the company's directors. Below and above, respondents do not dispute that as to Biglari and as to a respondent Cooley, we showed interestedness, and we submit that we've showed interestedness to Cooper, and we've also showed that Cooper and the entire governance, compensation, and nominating committee failed to exercise reasonable business judgment.
What does the record show about these directors, their qualifications, their relationship to Biglari?
So
are these pals of his? Or?
I would say that's true of Cooley, and I would say Cooper has a lot of overlapping ties. Below, we made arguments as to all six. We've abandoned as to three of the respondents. The only ones we press are as to Cooley and Cooper. Cooley was his college professor, has known him for approaching 16 years at this point in time, taught him, was involved in BCC from its founding. BCC was founded back in 2000. So predating the 2008 takeover. They worked together on those matters. Cooper, likewise, has been a long-term investor in the Lion Fund, which BCC is comprised of two funds, Lion Fund 1 and Lion Fund 2. Cooper is a long-term investor with $170,000 interest in the Lion Fund, and he benefited from the transaction. Biglari himself described it to his limited partners in the Lion Fund, the non-Biglari Holdings limited partners. He said that one of the benefits to them of this transaction that BCC repurchased in 2013 was that it would reduce administrative costs of the transaction. So he benefited in terms of protecting that transaction. The other tie that we identify in the record between Cooper and Biglari is that Cooper has an entity called Ascot Management, and they both serve as managers, directors of that entity together, and that's been for many years as well.
But you say there are four directors who are not...
There are three other directors. There's a total of six directors. Biglari.
But six includes Biglari.
Six inclusive of Biglari. The other three were not pressing on appeal the ties. We raised it below. We're not pressing that issue on appeal.
If the other three are not suspected of, you know, sort of collusion or some monetary stake in going along with Biglari, they outvote
Well, Your Honor, if it were three versus three, the standard is we need to show it to half of the board. And the reason under Carcinaro, and that's six...
Oh, I see. So, right, it's six. So it's Kubi, Kula, and and Biglari.
And so we cite, for example, on that point, Your Honor, Carcinaro, 65 A3rd at 637. That's 17 of our opening brief. The rationale in those cases is that if there's a deadlock, that impedes the company as well. So if half have a disqualifying interest, we win. But we further submit that as to the other four, non-Cooley and non-Biglari, that they fail to reasonably exercise business judgment, that we raise the requisite reasonable doubt. And at this stage, the standard is that we need to raise a reasonable doubt, not conclusively disprove the business judgment. And we submit, considering both the deliberations and the substance of these three transactions, shows the requisite reasonable net doubt as to the exercise of business judgment. First, talking about the licensing agreement, that agreement imposed a 2.5% royalty contingent. It doesn't kick into effect unless there's a triggering event, but if that kicks in, the company would have to pay Mr. Biglari 2.5% of gross revenues. That exceeds 80% of net operating earnings based on 2012 figures, meaning the most recent year before figures. The way the math works out on that is in 2012, the company had $740 million of earnings, so 2.5% of that is in excess of $18 million, $21.5 million in net earnings, so well over 80% of net earnings would go to Mr. Biglari. As the court might imagine, paying 80% plus of net earnings for a company for a five-year period destroys it, or at least fundamentally alters the business. That has the immediate effect of deterring would-be acquirers, deterring proxy contests. Similar, it's a long time ago case, but the court wrote in Dynamics Corp for CTS many years ago, talking about a poison pill that was implemented for entrenchment purposes, that when it's done to impede acquirers, impede proxy contests, that's classic entrenchment. And a royalty of this provision, of this magnitude, is classic entrenchment. What's particularly pernicious, though, is that it was done without meaningful deliberation. One would expect that in the event a board were going to impose such a draconian royalty, there would be a lot of valuation analysis, a lot of cost-benefit, both on what the asset side is and what the liability side or contingent liability side is. None of that is evident. What we have, the sum total of the end of deliberations, is a 1.5-page memo from an intellectual property attorney, not a valuation analysis, saying, well, there's some history of similar type of agreements, and there's a reference to an agreement with Martha Stewart. Putting aside the difference between Martha Stewart versus Home Products and Mr. Biglari versus Burgers and Steaks, which I think facially is incomparable, the scope of Ms. Stewart's royalty is far, far narrower, and it's really elective of the company. What Ms. Stewart's royalty, the memo says, provides is that should Martha Stewart's company desire to continue to sell Martha Stewart branded products, they can do so, but they have to pay a royalty. Basically, they make a choice. Is it in our business interest to continue to sell these products? Or if it's not, we cease to sell them and move on to other lines of product. Here, the royalty is effectively inescapable. It doesn't apply. There's no option to terminate. There's no option to pivot the business. It would have the effect of, on 2012 numbers, reducing 80% plus of gross revenues. So again, particularly considering the perniciousness of the royalty coupled with the minimalist deliberations and the fact that even that attorney's work product was shared with Mr. Biglari and that he drove the transaction, raises the requisite reasonable doubt as to business judgment. One final thought in opposition, what respondents say is, well, wait, the company here got valuable intellectual property, and that's the consideration to support this. But actually, the trademarks at issue were not ever first registered until many weeks after this transaction closed. So if this is truly valuable intellectual property, one would surmise it would have been safeguarded and at the very least registered with the trademark office prior to this transaction, if not many years before.
So the trademark involved adding Biglari's name?
So the specific trademarks...
On the theory that he's famous or something like that?
On the theory that there's value in his name, and right. The value in the name Biglari and the name Biglari Holdings.
Value to whom? I mean, he's not well known to the public.
I never heard of him before this case either, Your Honor. He's not, again, there's no deliberation. This is where the reasonable doubt comes in. It's not like the board said, hey, Biglari is going to attract additional capital of X amount or increase expected returns by X amount. The type of, even a back of envelope type of deliberations that, hey, there's this value add, there's nothing of the sort of those deliberations. It's all conclusory. It's all about a half paragraph comparison to Martha Stewart. And I think what Your Honor's touching on is precisely where we're troubled. There's no asset that we can discern. The quote-unquote asset is the trademarks, which aren't registered until after the fact. But even assuming there's some peppercorn of an asset, there's no deliberations. Any kind of major transaction, one would start, here's the asset, here's the liability, wholly absent from this kind of deliberation here. And we think that alone, particularly coupled with that memo itself is first sent to the Governance Compensation Nominating Committee. It's pretty cursory. It's first sent to them in a January 11th package. That same day, the agreement's approved. So it's not like this was the beginning of some long process where they started very basically and over the course of months or weeks, multiple meetings got deeper. This is kind of the beginning and the end of the deliberations. As to the Biglory Capital transaction, again, there's a memo, and that's Exhibit 9 to our complaint, which purports to rely on some kind of valuation analysis, although curiously it doesn't include that actual analysis, which says we're going to start with this range that Towers Watson, Towers Perrin gave us, and we're going to make adjustments. But what it doesn't account for at all, doesn't even mention, is that coterminously with that transaction, the company pledges $326 million in additional securities to Mr. Biglory, locks it up for a minimum of 5 years. That A, gives him a voting block, so he can now vote these securities. And there's a unique feature of Indiana law. This court decided this summer a case called Core Opportunities Fund versus Emmis, 792 F3rd at 739. And we discussed this case. Indiana law has a unique feature that a company can actually hold its own securities and retire them. Under Delaware law, and I believe Judge Easterbrook says in that opinion, the law of every other state, they're either retired or they're outstanding. Indiana has this kind of intermediate status, which is unique. And so what Biglory does is exploit that. And there's nothing, as Judge Easterbrook said in the opinion, there's nothing pernicious about that per se in Indiana law. The question is if it's done in a manner that's exploitive and for entrenchment purposes, that's where the requisite reasonable doubt is raised as to these issues. So again, there's no valuation component to the voting rights, no valuation component to the fact that he's now able to evade his compensation cap. What happens is Biglory Holdings pledges the securities to Biglory Capital, BCC. BCC is now one and the same as Mr. Biglory. He's the sole owner. No more board oversight, no more board control over these securities. He can earn whatever he wants on them, irrespective of the previously imposed and bargained for shareholder cap. And also as an oversight matter, because of the five-year lockup, if the board were to say after 2 years, you know what, the performance has been poor or we have a better option, they're precluded from doing so. It's locked up for a minimum of 5 years. We think, again, there's no deliberations on this. These are major transactions. Again, as I said before, in 2012, net profits were $20 million. So we're not talking about some $100 billion conglomerate where this is an immaterial or insignificant. This is the entirety of the franchise. And you're effectively giving away the entirety of the franchise with no deliberation, no valuation. As to what those deliberations do include, though, we take issue in our expert report, Professor Black takes issue with one of the material deductions they do make. They do make a $1.7 million adjustment, which kind of halves their bottom line valuation due to a supposed bonus obligation owed to Mr. Biglory. But that, again, is not extinguished by the transaction. Biglory Holdings had the obligation pre-transaction to Mr. Biglory. That obligation remains post-transaction, so it's what our expert, Professor Black, calls a phantom deduction. Now, respondents say, well, the district court didn't rely on Professor Black's conclusions, but really no one challenges his bona fides. There's numerous Delaware decisions in the record below where Professor Black, who's professor at Northwestern and has taught at numerous other esteemed institutions in this corporate governance arena, there's no challenge to his bona fides, just no consideration by the district court.
Mr. Wagner,
yes.
Could I ask you about the argument of your opponents that the first prong of the Aronson analysis was waived by your raising it in reply?
What they say specifically is it's waived as to Mr. Cooper. I don't think anyone disputes that it's not waived as to Mr. Biglory or Mr. Cooley. As to Mr. Cooper, the sites where we raised that in our opening brief are pages 10 and 12, where I believe we raised it. The Ascot Holdings part is on a footnote on one of those pages, and in the body there we talk specifically about Mr. Cooper's long-term interest in the company. Another instance where that appears in the record, using this court's docket entries, docket entry 20-3, page 447, specifically quantifies Mr. Cooper's interest. But I think the reference to Cooper's interest is both in the complaint and repeatedly in the record. But again, as to the other two, there's no dispute, and as to the second prong, I believe there's no dispute. Finally, turning to the last transaction, the rights offering, the issue here is that this kind of cascades with the other two transactions. We have, several months before, this likeness agreement, this licensing agreement, which effectively makes Big Lorry and the board removable. Shortly thereafter, a few months thereafter, we have this BCC transaction, which locks up securities, and this is kind of the last shoe dropping. Admittedly, the control ultimately gained by this is less than the first two transactions, but the point is that this was done, again, without deliberation, without meaningful consideration, done by unanimous consent of the GCN, and again, it has further the effect of increasing Mr. Big Lorry's holdings at the expense of minority shareholders. So unless the court has further questions, well,
that,
I reserve.
That raised a great deal of money, though, didn't it?
It raised $75 million, which obviously $75 million is $75 million. But again, if you look at that it's following the BCC transaction, Big Lorry controls as the capital allocator. He basically has sole discretion allocation. He can now, should he wish, move that to Big Lorry Capital. And that becomes, instead of the $326 million, that can now become $400 million that he uses to evade his compensation cap, that he uses to vote
to
the
what?
Stuff.
He can move that money to what?
He can move it to BCC. And that's now a new five-year lockup. One
it
final point.
It didn't increase the ownership share that much, did it, by Big Lorry?
It was 0.7%. The big 16% block comes with a BCC transaction. That's true, Your Honor. One last point. There's a statement that in the opposition that, hey, you know, you say the likeness agreement deters proxy contests, but in fact, in 2015, there was a proxy contest. And what we say in reply and cite articles that subject to judicial notice for this point is that the proxy advisors, ISS and other advisors, say, don't vote against Big Lorry because you're going to have to pay $100 million on this. So the fact that someone could try and wage a futile war is not material. The materiality is that this ultimately dissuaded and impacted the proxy contest.
Okay, thank you. Is Ms. Wolka isn't going to...
She is at table, Your Honor, but she's given me her time.
Okay, thank you very much. So, Mr. Clark?
May it please the Court, Chris Clark for Big Lorry Holdings and the Board of Big Lorry Holdings. I think Mr. Wagner's last point was the most important. There was a proxy contest. The shareholders of the company could have voted for any one of the replacement of the board members. For the replacement of the board members other than Mr. Big Lorry, for the replacement of the board members who voted for any of these transactions, all of which were highly publicized by the people who ran the proxy contest, all of which were at issue in the suit that was brought by the plaintiffs, the shareholders knew about each one of these transactions when they were asked to vote, and it wasn't an all-or-nothing slate. It's not a classified board at Big Lorry. So they could have left Mr. Big Lorry on, not had to pay under the trademark assignment agreement at all, and replaced every other board member.
I don't know how it relates to the demand futility issue.
I think the plaintiffs are trying to put atmospherics forward, Your Honor, and I think those atmospherics are important to note that demand futility, especially in Indiana, is a statement by the legislature that it wants boards, and at that then at a remove shareholders writ large to control litigation, not single shareholders, not plaintiffs, and with all due respect to the court in Indiana and this court, not courts. Boards make better decisions. For instance, there's a lot of rhetoric in this case about the $100 million.
Well, the demand is supposed to be, it is for the board, right?
Well, it was never made, Your Honor. That's right. There was no demand made.
Yes, I know. The question is whether, given the composition of the board and their deference to Big Lorry and so on, whether there would be any point.
Right. Absolutely. And the standard is the following. Was any member of the board so conflicted that no reasonable fact finder could think they would fairly take a look at the demand? There's concession as to three members of the board.
That leaves three.
Well, but hold on, Your Honor, because as to two of these transactions, including the trademark transaction, they were approved by the GCN.
I don't understand the trademark transaction.
Okay.
I can't see his name as adding a lot of value.
I understand that's Your Honor's opinion. You made it clear when Mr. Wagner was presenting.
He's not a famous person.
He is a very, very prominent investor, Your Honor. And boards are delegated this strategy. Is it worth it? is it worth it in the long run? This is a licensing agreement that costs $0. Mr. Wagner misspoke, actually. It is not irredeemable. The board, if it wants to, at a change of control, can forgive the payment. And the board has a fiduciary duty.
But he controls the board.
He does not control the board, Your Honor.
His pals.
There is nothing in this record that these are his pals, Your Honor. There's nothing in this record. I'm sorry, Your Honor, but that's just speculation.
With Kubi and Kubi, there's nothing?
Nothing in this record. So first of all, there's no allegation as to three of the six members. We conceded below Dr. Cooley. There was no proof put on. We conceded Dr. Cooley. We may not have had to. Mr. Cooper, the sole allegation with regard to Mr. Cooper is that he's an investor in the Lion Fund. Do you know who the largest investor in the Lion Fund is? The shareholders of Biglari Holdings. The one claimed disqualification of Mr. Cooper is that his economic interest is utterly aligned with the shareholders of the company. That can't be a disqualification. Obviously, it's a well-stated premise of New York Stock Exchange listing rules and all the various shareholder advisory boards that we want board members to be invested in the securities of the companies that they represent. That's what Mr. Cooper's done. He's invested, and it's all over the record. And in fact, they point to the fact.
I don't think that's correct. We also want independent board members.
We do, Your Honor. And think about it.
We don't want all the board members to be invested in the company.
We don't want all the board members to be invested in the company. Well, there are others who aren't on this board. So that's fine. But we want some that are and some that aren't. Mr. Cooper is one who has the exact same financial interest in
but you're arguing about the composition of the board rather than this first transaction. The fact that it gives him the opportunity eventually to obtain virtually the entire income of the company.
That's a canard, Your Honor. It's an absolute canard. So first of all, if Your Honor looks, which is in the record, at the annual report of the company right now, as of the end of 2014, holds $766.6 million in cash, marketable securities, and investments. None of that money is subject to this agreement. This agreement relates to 2.5% of the gross revenues from operations of the company.
But that constitutes a very large percentage of the company's profits.
It doesn't, Your Honor, because if you look at the amount of money that's been made over the years and the way that the increase in the investments, and Biglari Holdings told all its shareholders, our purpose is to invest your money. That's what we do. We invest your money and we grow it and we hold it. And that money has grown, if you'll allow me 1 second, Your Honor.
Sure, take your time.
From 2011, there was $252 million in such investments. 2012, $378. 2013, $365. And 2014, $766 million that Mr. Biglari, in his sole discretion, made for the shareholders, which is never going to be paid out pursuant to the licensing agreement. So I take issue with Your Honor's statement.
I'm talking about the 2.7%.
Right.
Royalty.
That's revenue, Your Honor. In a given year.
Yes, but given the rather limited income of the company itself, that 2.7% of revenues constitutes a large fraction of the net worth of the company.
Well, but as Your Honor understands, the board understood as well or better, revenue and income are two matters that can be adjusted based on the strategic goals of the company. So, for instance, as the company grew these investments greatly, it has certain tax liabilities. It could realize much more income if it wanted to, but it's decided not to, and that's all publicly disclosed, because it doesn't want to undertake those tax liabilities. And these kinds of complicated decisions about how to realize income, what to do with revenue, what kind of strategic goals to pursue, this is what gets deferred to an unconflicted board. And that's what you have here, Your Honor. I honestly don't think there's an honest dispute. Mr. Wagner, I saw Your Honor write down some of the citations to the Cooper references in the brief. It just basically says Mr. Cooper. It is never argued that he's conflicted in the opening brief. Not a single time. We searched through the brief and put in the words Cooper and conflict, and it doesn't turn up in that brief. And the court may do that. So there's not a real argument here that it's a conflicted board. And what Indiana law, more so than any other state's law in this country, says is you give it to that board. And for these reasons, Your Honor, we're talking about complicated numbers, whether or not you'd want to realize income from revenue, what kinds of tax liabilities the company's going to have from the $750 million that Mr. Biglari made for the company. Those are decisions that boards should make because they understand it. Mr. Wagner said several times up here, there was no deliberation. There was no deliberation. That's false. There are board minutes that he got in discovery. There are resolutions.
Well, I don't understand. I thought the argument was that this 2.7% royalty would translate itself into most of the revenue or the net worth of the company.
Let me see if I can unpack it for Your Honor, because it's tricky math. It's 2.5% of gross revenues, which by any measure is a modest measure. It's not 50%, it's not 75%. In a given year, a company may, especially an investment company, may decide to realize revenues in various ways. For instance, Biglari Holdings has had $500 million of securities gains in the last few years. If it holds them, it realizes no income, and it has no tax. If it sells them, it realizes income, but no revenue. So there's this giant pot of money sitting over here that's never subject to the agreement, but could greatly increase income if the company wanted to and it wanted to take the tax hit on it. So the idea that because the company made a policy decision in 1 year to not pay income taxes and that this would somehow devastate the profitability of the company is not true. It flies in the face of the facts, but also it again underlies why boards decide these things. The board knows. The board has these financial statements in front of it. The board talks to the CFO, and the board makes policy decisions, which, by the way, are written in the annual report about what it wants to do about the taxation of these securities it owns, what it wants to do about investments. So I understand that the numbers sound big when put that way, but they're not. The company could have realized a profit on $500 million of securities if it wanted to, and that would have an enormous effect on the income. And it would make 2.5% of its operating revenues virtually meaningless. Now, I underline, though, Your Honor, the fact that Mr. Wagner is wrong anyway, that this agreement, if, for instance, a company wanted to acquire Biglari Holdings, can basically be thrown away by the board, all of whom has a fiduciary duty to shareholders right now, and all of whom can be challenged at that time. Not a dime has been paid under this agreement right now. There's no damage. If it becomes relevant, somebody can challenge the board members then when we have some real facts. But right now, it's really asking this court on very limited information to second guess a fully informed and very able board, the majority of which there is no challenge to their independence. We don't claim Mr. Biglari was independent. I think with connection to the BCC transaction, which was raised, I think the important thing to keep in mind there is in 2010, Biglari Capital Corporation was owned by Mr. Biglari. He sold it to the company for $1. It's undisputed. In 2013, he bought it back, it's undisputed, for $1.7 million. It's difficult for me, knowing those facts, to wonder why that's an unfair transaction to the company. It seems to me, under the business judgment rule, if the $1 property in 2010 got sold back for $1, that would be perfectly fair and reasonable. The company worked out a transaction where it derived a $1.6 million profit. And there's nothing about the fully disclosed, fully vetted BCC transaction that in any way disadvantages the company. It's the same economics that it had before. as the company stated in its SEC filings, the reason for it was certain people, analysts and shareholders, said it would be much easier to understand the corporation if this were unpacked. Company disclosed that. It's, I think the district judge even quotes it, and that's the reason for that transaction. Nothing more. Finally, the rights transaction is, you know, again, I think this really shows the level to which the plaintiffs are trying to second-guess a board. It's an unmitigated boon to the corporation. The corporation makes $75 million. Mr. Biglari gets, and again, I guess one thing I'd like to say is, you know, the speculation in the complaint almost always turns out to be untrue in this case. There's speculation that there'll never be a proxy contest because of the licensing agreement. Lo and behold, there's a proxy contest. There's speculation that Mr. Biglari will vastly increase his voting percentages because of the rights offering. He got 637 more votes or shares than he had before. 637. It did nothing to increase his control. What it did was it gained the company $75 million at a very competitive price. Moreover, it benefited all existing shareholders because it was sold to them at a discount. So when you start to really unpack these transactions and look at the merits of them, which the board did, and which is the board's job, you can see that they're utterly fair to the corporation, but that's not my burden, right? My burden isn't to show, as plaintiffs want it to be, that these are good deals or these are deals that this court would endorse. My burden is to show, under Indiana law, that the board didn't engage in reckless or willful misconduct. That's the level of bad stuff they had to do. It's not the familiar Delaware standard of irrationality, which is a very high standard. It is whether or not the board engaged in reckless or willful misconduct. And I submit that this doesn't come close to that. And to the extent that anybody has any questions about the economic basis for the trademark transaction, that's a matter best left to a board. One further issue that I'd like to address for the court.
The trademark thing seems very strange. Why his name should have...
Your Honor, I understand that Your Honor's view is that Mr. Biglari is not a well-known person. He's a very prominent investor, and I guess the way that it was put to the board and thought about by the board is...
I don't understand. What is his name... Yes, sophisticated investors don't care whether his name is in the... is in their advertising, right?
Well, we're not necessarily just going after sophisticated investors, Your Honor.
Pardon?
We're not necessarily just going after sophisticated investors. It's a public company. I think there's
They've never heard of Biglari.
I beg to differ. I'd like to answer it two ways.
Do you think the unsophisticated investor has heard of Biglari?
I do. I think that he's covered very vastly on websites like The Motley Fool and the kind of, I don't want to call them day traders, the kind of sites that people follow when they're looking to invest small amounts of money. But I think there are two reasons, Your Honor. The first is, if somebody could have gotten a trademark to Warren Buffett's name for free in 1963 at the price of having him around, they would have done it. And Your Honor can disagree with this board that Mr.
Biglari... Oh, this is the new Buffett.
That's what this board thinks. That's what this board believes. And you know what, Your Honor? The results of this corporation seem to indicate that right now.
How old is he?
He's, I think, 36 years old.
Look,
can I answer it one more way, Your Honor?
Getting back to that, the licensing agreement.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, in 2012, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but in 2012, the 2.5% would have been $17.5 million.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And he would get the $17.5 million. But the net earnings in 2012 were only $21 million.
That's right.
So he would walk away with most of the earnings.
First of all, Your Honor.
This is if he'd been removed as CEO and so on.
Three things. First of all, no payments have been made. Secondly, the board...
That's not the question, of course.
Right, I understand. The board is able to decide, and particularly in this company, how much income it's going to realize from its investments. So, for instance, in the next year, right, Your Honor, between 2012 and 2013, It gained approximately, I'm going to do the math wrong, $250 million in investments directed by Mr. Biglari. It chose not to realize those gains. And so its income is lower. Mm-hmm. And so, and look, obviously that's why they've cherry-picked the number of income, right? But those are gains to the shareholders. They own that. It's an increase in the value of the company. The board just chose not to pay taxes on it and realize income. But it can, and it can when it thinks it's the right time. And so it's, again, Your Honor, it's a canard to say that 1 year's income that got set when the company knew it didn't have to pay is somehow a measure of the economic impact of this. There's $766 million sitting in a piggy bank right here that's never affected by that contract. And it's growing every day. That's based on end of year 2014. 2015, we'll expect to be much higher. So it really is a matter of the board can control and understands these numbers, and that's why it's delegated to them.
What were the reported gains in 2014?
From 2013? Is that the question, Your Honor?
What was the reported income?
Oh, the income.
2014.
I don't know that I have the income statement in front of me, Your Honor. I again would gather that it was kept low because there's a substantial investment gain that's marked from 635 to 766. And there's commentary in the annual report about not wanting to pay taxes on that income. So not wanting to realize that income and pay taxes on it. So I would gather it was kept low. This is a long-term growth company. It's taking the money it earns and it's not realizing it as income. It's investing it. That's what it does. That's what its shareholders are told it does. And so to say that if you look at net revenue, or rather gross revenue, and its impact on net income is somehow the financial health of the company, it's absolutely wrong. And the board knows that. And investors know that. Again, Your Honor, if the investors were up in arms about this transaction, which they fully knew about, they could have kicked out every single board member except Mr. Biglari, and they could have taken what they wanted. That's not what they did. They voted everybody back in. Mm-hmm. One other matter before Your Honor has a question.
No, go ahead.
I think it's important that, I don't think it's outcome determinative here. I think the court obviously has taken a searching look at this case, and I think we went under de novo. I think this court's law is that you review this case for an abuse of discretion. I think there's a little bit of confusion.
What does that mean?
I think that it's the same standard that you...
I wish someone would tell me someday, what does abuse of discretion mean?
I think that you take the district court's well-reasoned opinion, unless you find that she has made clear errors of law, or has made, you know, clear errors in adopting inferences, that you affirm. That the court obviously has made some searching thought about this case.
What if you just think she's wrong?
I don't think you can reverse on an abuse of discretion standard then.
I don't get that.
Your Honor knows better than I, but...
So in other words, you have an appellate court and says, no, this decision is wrong. But we can't say it's insanely wrong.
Well, we didn't, but earlier there was talk about clear error in the context of the criminal appeal. Clear error...
I don't
get
that either.
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I mean, if you think someone has been wrongly convicted, what are you going to say? We think that he's wrongly convicted, but who knows? Judge disagreed.
Well, I think absolute innocence trumps clear error. So I agree with Your Honor on that. I think here, abuse of discretion means, again, and particularly in this case, where full document discovery was granted to the plaintiffs, where they had every piece of paper they'd have after summary judgment, and where the district court reviewed all of that, had it in front of her, and really went through it, that I think there is a level of deference that should be given to her conclusions. Mm-hmm. If there's no... Oh, sorry, Your Honor.
Just as an aside, when you were discussing with Judge Posner the notoriety or lack thereof of Mr. Biglari...
Correct.
Is he well-known in the restaurant investing area? Is that where his...
That was the second part of the question that I wanted to give to Judge Posner, pardon me. Again, in the annual report, one of the main areas of expansion for Steak and Shake right now is the Middle East. That's where they're targeting. It's a company that's mature in the United States. The Middle East and Europe are where they're going.
Middle East?
Yes, Kuwait, Riyadh,
wow.
And they're extraordinarily
Syria.
Syria not, but
Libya.
I think they have eight stores in Riyadh, Turkey. And they're franchise stores. And Mr. Biglari is actually a very high-profile person in the Middle East, and he's a famous guy for having escaped Iran with his parents, hidden out in Istanbul as a kid, come to the United States, and made a great success of himself. And so there is a cachet to his name there that's higher than it is here in the restaurant industry. That's right, Your Honor.
That's very interesting.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Mr. Clark. And Mr. Wagner, do you have anything further?
I'd like to walk through the numbers because there was some confusion, I think, in what Mr. Clark said. The two inputs are gross revenues, which is the 2.5% is paid of, and then we're comparing that to net revenues, which is another way of saying profitability. The 2.5% is off gross revenues. And what you heard from Mr. Clark was, well, focusing on net revenues in 1 year is misleading. In the record we have, and this is docket entry 20-2, page 118, we have the five-year earnings preceding this, 2012 back to 2006. Lest the court think we cherry-picked, I'd like to talk about 2009. We talked about 2012. In 2009, the royalty that would be due to Mr. Biglari would be 261% of net earnings, i.e. 261% of profit. They'd have to dip into their investments to pay that. And you heard, well, the company's had a lot of investment gains, but investment gains are not the same as net not earnings. There's going to be SG&A expenses. There's going to be taxes. There's all sorts of expenses that would have to get paid before you get to that net earnings figure. And then the whole of net earnings, or sometimes 261% of it, get wiped away. And I can do, if the court would like, the mathematics on the 261. It's $629 million of earnings. 2.5% of that is over $13
million. Well, what Mr. Clark was saying was that the reported net earnings figure is not necessarily the economically meaningful earnings of the company.
But over 5 years, Your Honor, their net earnings never hit over $30 million. So this is not an instance. Their highest
never exceeded.
Yeah, and they were as low as $6 million. So this 21.5 is kind of down Main Street. They've been slightly better, and they've been quite a bit worse over a five-year trailing period. As far as the statement that in a proxy contest they could get rid of the whole board, that's completely untrue. One of the triggers, perhaps the most pernicious trigger in the likeness agreement, is that there's a change of control, i.e. the majority of the board gets turned over, the payment goes to Mr. Biglari. And that's not a matter for the board to waive. It goes to Mr. Biglari. He would have to personally waive it. He doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want to give up his voting block. He doesn't want to give up his $10 million base compensation plus the BCC opportunity to evade it. There's simply no reason to believe he would have done it. In fact, if he was going to waive it, I'm not sure why he would have bothered with these transactions to begin with. But again, there's no deliberation of that fact. There's no consideration. A brief word about the standards. The standard of showing of recklessness is the standard at trial. The standard at the pleading stage is to raise a reasonable doubt. In Abbott Labs and in Westmoreland, this court has repeatedly stated, construing Delaware law, which Indiana law follows, that the question is just to raise a question as to business judgment. It's not proof of the ultimate issues here. Finally, as far as what Indiana law and how deferential it is, the most recent Indiana Supreme Court case, which we cite, they don't talk about it at all in their briefs. We cite in our opening and reply is the TP Orthodontics case. And what that talks about is deliberations can't be shallow in execution or restricted in scope. And unfortunately, I think those are precisely the sort of deliberations we have here. Lastly, on the de novo versus abusive discretion, I agree with Your Honor. It's telling when you talk about some instances where I know abuse of discretion applies, amending complaints, for example. You get into issues of undue delay, and that's where you have trial court deference. We don't have any of these type of undue delay sort of issues here. And again, the standard here is have we raised a reasonable doubt? We submit we have, and that means that it's a legal error to find otherwise.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next case.